On their way back to London, they stopped at the Television Corporation's factory at Brentford. "Do you mind waiting here a moment while I go and telephone?" asked Bernard. The savage waited and watched. The main day shift was just going off duty. Crowds of lower-caste workers were queued up in front of the monorail station. 700 or 800 Gamma, Delta and Epsilon men and women, with not more than a dozen faces and statures between them. To each of them, with his or her ticket, the booking clerk pushed over a little cardboard pillbox. The long caterpillar of men and women moved slowly forward.
"What's in those?" remembering the Merchant of Venice. "Those caskets?"
the savage inquired, when Bernard had rejoined him.
"The Dissumer Russian,"
Bernard answered rather indistinctly, for he was masticating a piece of Benito Hoover's chewing gum.
"They get it after their work's over. 4 half-gram tablets, 6 on Saturdays."
He took John's arm affectionately, and they walked back towards the helicopter. Lenina came singing into the changing room.
"You seem very pleased with yourself," said Fanny.
"I am pleased," she answered. Zip. Bernard rang up half an hour ago. Zip, zip. She stepped out of her shorts. "He has an unexpected engagement." Zip. "Ask me if I take the savage to the Feelers this evening. I must fly." She hurried away towards the bathroom.
"She's a lucky girl," Fanny said to herself as she watched Lenina go.
There was no envy in the comment. Good-natured Fanny was merely stating a fact. Lenina was lucky. Lucky in having shared with Bernard a generous portion of the savage's immense celebrity. Lucky in reflecting from her insignificant person the moment's supremely fashionable glory. Had not the secretary of the Young Women's Fordian Association asked her to give her a lecture about her experiences? Had she not been invited to the annual dinner of the Aphroditeum Club? Had she not already appeared in the Feelytone News, visibly, audibly, and tactually appeared to countless millions all over the planet? Hardly less flattering had been the attentions paid her by conspicuous individuals. The resident world controller's second secretary had asked her to dinner and breakfast. She had spent one weekend with the Ford Chief Justice and another with the arch-community songster of Canterbury. The president of the Internal and External Secretions Corporation was perpetually on the phone, and she had been to Deauville with the deputy governor of the Bank of Europe. "It was wonderful, of course, and yet in a way," she had confessed to Fanny, "I feel as though I were getting something on false pretenses. But, of course, the first thing they all want to know is what it's like to make love to a savage. And I have to say, I don't know." She shook her head. "Most of the men don't believe me, of course. But it's true. I wish it weren't," she added sadly and sighed. "He's terribly good-looking, don't you think so?"
"But doesn't he like you?" asked Fanny.
"Sometimes I think he does, and sometimes I think he doesn't. He always does his best to avoid me, goes out of the room when I come in, won't touch me, won't even look at me. But sometimes, if I turn round suddenly, I catch him staring. And then, well, you know how men look when they like you." Yes, Fanny knew.
"I can't make it out," said Lenina.
She couldn't make it out, and not only was bewildered, but also rather upset. "Because, you see, Fanny, I like him." Liked him more and more. Well, now there'd be a real chance, she thought, as she scented herself after the bath. Dab, dab, dab. A real chance. Her high spirits overflowed in song.
"Hug me till you drug me, honey. Kiss me till I'm in a coma. Hug me, honey, struggly bunny. Love's as good as soma."
The scent organ was playing a delightfully refreshing herbal capriccio, rippling arpeggios of thyme and lavender, of rosemary, basil, myrtle, tarragon, a series of daring modulations through the spice keys into ambergris, and a slow return through sandalwood, camphor, cedar, and new-mown hay, with occasional subtle touches of discord, a whiff of kidney pudding, the faintest suspicion of pig's dung, back to the simple aromatics with which the piece began. The final blast of time died away. There was a round of applause, The lights went up. In the synthetic music machine, the soundtrack roll began to unwind. It was a trio for hyperviolin, supercello, and oboe surrogate that now filled the air with its agreeable languor. 30 or 40 bars, and then, against this instrumental background, a much more than human voice began to warble, now throaty, now from the head, now hollow as a flute, now charged with yearning harmonics. It effortlessly passed from Gaspard Forster's slow record on the very frontiers of musical tone to a trilled bat note high above the highest C to which, in 1770, at the Ducal Opera of Parma, and to the astonishment of Mozart, Lucrezia Adjugari, alone of all the singers in history, once piercingly gave utterance.